Please join me now for a time of prayer and meditation. These are the words of Robert T. Weston, Out of the Stars. Out of the stars in their flight, out of the dust of eternity, here we have come. Stardust and sunlight mingling through time and through space. Out of the stars have we come, up from time. Out of the stars have we come. Time out of time, before time, in the vastness of space, Earth spun to orbit the sun. Earth with the thunder of mountains newborn, the boiling of seas. Earth formed by sun, lit by sunlight. This is our home. Out of the stars have we come. Mystery hidden in mystery, back through all time. Mystery rising from rocks in the storm and the sea. Out of the stars, rising from rocks in the sea, kindled by sunlight on earth, arose life. Ponder this thing in your heart. Ponder with awe. Out of the sea to the land, out of the shallows came ferns. Out of the sea to the land, up from darkness to light. Rising to walk and to fly, out of sea trembled life. Ponder this thing in your heart. Life, up from the sea. Eyes to behold, throats to sing, mates to love. Life from the sea, warmed by sun, washed by rain. Life from within, giving birth, rose to love. This is the wonder of time. This is the marvel of space. Out of the stars swung the earth. Life upon earth rose to love. This is the marvel of life. Rising to see and to know. Out of your heart, cry wonder. Sing that we live.
Good morning, everybody. My first reading this morning is from a book called Life Tides by the Reverend Elizabeth Tarbox. I picked up a horse chestnut Friday, right on the street in Cambridge near Harvard Divinity School. Imagine that, a perfectly new horse chestnut. There were more for the picking had not my shyness and the stares of passers-by prevented me from darting and pouncing to gather them up. When I was a child, horse chestnuts were currency. Conkers, we called them. Better than a sixpence or even a shilling, a new conker had market value. Kids couldn't wait to harvest the green prickly cocoon with its polished mahogany prize. We'd climb the branches and knock the conkers off with a stick. No adult would have gotten near a bonanza like the one I found on Friday. Funny, the things we value. A new coat or a new car, a job that pays better, a best friend, or a good night's sleep. Me, I have always valued gifts from the earth. I hold this horse chestnut as I write about it. The warm brown nut fits in my palm like a thumb in a baby's mouth, and the rich, shiny skin gives my eyes something worthy of their sight. So I stare at it as if it were a crystal that could show me not the future, but the past. Autumns of childhood and wading in Wellington boots through the rustling leaves and playing with conkers on my way home from school. The end of the first reading. This reading is by Annie Dillard, and it comes from her book that you've heard me reference many, many times, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. And this is just a little bit different. When I was 6 or 7 years old, growing up in Pittsburgh, I used to take a precious penny of my own and hide it for someone else to find. It was a curious compulsion. Sadly, I've never been seized by it since. For some reason, I always hid the penny along the same stretch of sidewalk up the street. I would cradle it at the roots of a sycamore, say, or in a hole left by a chipped-off piece of sidewalk. Then I would take a piece of chalk and, starting at either end of the block, draw huge arrows leading up to the penny from both directions. After I learned to write, I labeled the arrows "Surprise Ahead" or "Money This Way." I was greatly excited during all this arrow drawing at the thought of the first lucky passerby who would receive in this way, regardless of merit, a free gift from the universe. But I never lurked about. I would go straight home and not give the matter another thought until some months later I would be gripped again by the impulse to hide another penny. I've been thinking about seeing. There are lots of things to see, unwrapped gifts and free surprises. The world is fairly studded and strewn with pennies cast broadside from a generous hand. But, and this is the point, who gets excited by a mere penny? If you follow one arrow, if you crouch motionless on a bank to watch a tremulous ripple thrill on the water, and are rewarded by the sight of a muskrat kit paddling from its den, will you count the sight a chip of copper only and go your rueful way? It is dire poverty indeed when a person is so malnourished and fatigued that she won't stoop to pick up a penny. But if you cultivate a healthy poverty and simplicity so that finding a penny will literally make your day, then, since the world is in fact planted in pennies, you have, with your poverty, bought a lifetime of days. It is that simple. What you see is what you get. End of the second reading. Reverence and reverence. April, T.S. Eliot tells us, is the cruelest month. Eliot refers to miracles of April, stirring dull roots with spring rain and breathing lilacs out of the dead land. Well, now, I'm new to Texas, even though I lived in the neighboring states of Arkansas and Oklahoma when I was a settled minister. I don't remember if there were lilacs then. I don't remember. And about April being the cruelest month, well, it may be so. But for my money, this weekend, March weekend, has been just about the cruelest possible, except for right now. We were just getting used to warmth and sunshine and blossoming trees and leaves coming bright green now. I notice how bright green the leaves are. And now it's back to the woolen blankets and the long underwear. Well, I'm complaining because I just came out of 4 years of serving congregations in the far north, and so I was hoping this would be different. But other things that Eliot says about April are relevant here, even if I do seem to be rushing the season. April mixes memory and desire, says Eliot. April is a pivot point, a time when we look back in memory and forward in desire. Certainly you here at First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin are approaching a number of pivot points in your search for a permanent minister. Soon the Board of Trustees will select a search committee, and that committee will find a candidate for this church, for the professional ministry of this congregation. And in due course, you members will vote on that, on the proposal to call that minister. So it is natural for you now to look back on memories of former ministers whom you have known here and ministers you have known elsewhere. We are called to memory. And then you look ahead in desire to the time when you will feel well served by a new called minister who will walk with you into your potential and stay with you for a number of years. The earth's wish for promise and assurance is made manifest to us as we observe even now the blossoming trees and soon the flowers. We look forward with eagerness to the future. We are called to desire. Before that happens, there is another pivotal point. The interim ministry task force, much as it did last year, is now hard at work. This fall, you will warmly greet the interim minister whom they select, who will guide you through your second year of transition. Well, there is still time to make your wishes known if you want to be considered for the called minister search committee. Michael West is liaison to the board, and there's a note in your this week's announcements for you, and also there is an application on the church website for you to fill out if you are interested. So this congregation is engaged in multiple pivot points in church life and in metaphorical life. You have the opportunity, even though it is still March, to look back in memory and to look forward in desire. In my sermon title, I used the word reverends, E-N-D-S, meaning someone who has been ordained. Actually, reverend is not a noun, but an adjective, much like you would say the honorable so-and-so. It would be the reverend so-and-so. The title of my sermon, then, Reverence, Reverence and Reverends, is grammatically incorrect, but it tells you that today I want to speak very briefly about professional ministers and how they got that way. This is in line with my monthly theme of ministry for March. And as far as that other term in my sermon title, Reverence, E-N-C-E, I want to refer to a recent book by that same title, authored by Paul Woodruff, a professor of the humanities at the University of Texas. He's right down the street. In it, Woodruff says, quote, "Reverence begins in a deep understanding of human limitations. From this grows the capacity to be in awe of whatever we believe lies outside our control, God, truth, justice, nature, even death. The capacity for awe, as it grows, brings with it the capacity for respecting fellow human beings, flaws and all. Reverence is the virtue that keeps human beings from trying to act like gods. To forget that you are only human, to think you can act like a god, this is the opposite of reverence." End quote. Using Woodruff's terms, we would not want our ministers acting as if they were gods and becoming the opposite of reverent. And yet we wish to hold our clergy in high regard, not godlike, mind you, but typically we do hold ministers to high standards. And when they fail to meet those standards, we can be greatly disappointed. Have you ever noticed that Unitarian Universalists can be deeply critical of their ministers? Forbid the thought. The most scathing review that of a preacher that I know of was written by our own Unitarian, Ralph Waldo Emerson, in his Divinity School address of 1838, now some 72 years ago this spring. See if this still holds true. This is some abridgments from the Divinity School address. I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say I would go to church no more. A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real, and the preacher merely spectral, and the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him and then out the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had no one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely, to convert life into truth, he had not learned. This man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books. He had eaten and drunken. His head aches, his heart throbs. He smiles and suffers. Yet there was not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all. The true preacher can be known by this, that he deals out to the people his life, life passed through the fire of thought. But of the bad preacher, it could not be told from his sermon what age of the world he fell in, whether he had a father or a child, whether he was a freeholder or a pauper, whether he was a citizen or a countryman, or any other fact of his biography. It seemed strange that the people should come to church. Well, that is the end of that portion of Emerson's idea. I think if I had been Barzilai Frost at that moment, I would have quit immediately rather than have his opinion of me tossed around for a century and three quarters. True preachers can be known by this, that they deal out to the people their life, life passed through the fire of thought. I believe that it is the minister's job, whether ordained or lay, reverend or not, to experience and articulate reverence and to encourage it in others. And using Emerson's idea that preachers deal out to the people their life passed through the fire of thought, I mean reverence for thought, reverence for life, and reverence for the fire. The first of Emerson's themes, reverence for thought, is traditionally easy for us religious liberals to embrace. Of course we extol thought. Isn't that why reason is one of our foundations, as well as freedom of inquiry and tolerance? And isn't that why we have always valued a learned ministry? Now, our clergy in some congregations are expected to write scholarly papers and publish them in journals, preach research-laden sermons, hold their own in interfaith theological discussions. I admire my colleagues enormously for their gifts of scholarship. And at the same time, I believe that ministry calls all of us to exercise our faculties of reason in season and out in matters of religion. All around us, we have evidence of unreasoning religion. We have only to turn on the TV or radio for a few moments of the televangelists, or listen or read some of our elected officials and other world leaders to realize this. Some of it is prattle, but some of it is dangerous. Mindless and destructive dogmatism can prey on people's fears, anxieties, and prejudices, making for easy manipulation and scapegoating. When political operatives insist upon mindless loyalty to nationalistic doctrine instead of clear reasoning and objective observation, then I would say tyranny has triumphed. The world needs our reverence for thought as a counter to tyranny of all kinds, including political and religious tyranny. In regard for reverence for thought, I would add the quality of thoughtfulness as well as reason. Thoughtfulness can mean mindfulness or loving kindness, as the Buddhists would call it. All of our scholarly thought, all of our papers and sermons have as their purpose the improvement of human life. And all life is lived in relationship, or as Martin Buber puts it, in the in-between. Forbearance is a quality of thought in relationship, giving one another the benefit of the doubt as we ourselves would like that benefit. All of this contributes to reverence for thought in our ministry and our ministers. Now let's look at the second term that Emerson uses, reverence for life. Some of you know this story about Albert Schweitzer that he tells in his autobiography about how this term, reverence for life, came to him. Schweitzer had spent many months, years, studying, working, pondering, all of the time grappling with the question, what is the meaning of my responsibility in the world? And then one day, he says, as his boat was making its way through a herd of hippos in an African river, the phrase came to him as if someone had spoken it, reverence for life. And so he made this concept the central core of his life's work. My exemplar for today is poet and essayist Annie Dillard. Dillard says, as you remember from the reading, that a healthy poverty and simplicity help us to marvel at the bounty of nature, such as the sight of a muskrat kit paddling from its den, all unaware of us on the bank, to marvel and wonder and to be enlarged, rather than turning away, feeling rueful and cheated. We do indeed have a choice, she says, whether we will stoop to pick up life's pennies, free gifts from the universe, or whether we will go our way blind to small miracles. The minister, especially, needs to remain aware of the pennies. The reverend needs to maintain reverence in the presence of life's wonders and mystery. So, you're saying, in addition to the expectation that the minister will be a teacher, preacher, pastor, spiritual guide, social activist, administrator, what else? I put a whole bunch of those in my column last month. Now we want the minister to be a naturalist? Yes, to revere life. We must be where life is. But that doesn't necessarily mean living alone in a cabin in the woods, as Annie Dillard did. Life is among us and within us and all around us. It is a miracle that we are alive each day, and we need to pay attention. The new minister complains to a mentor, "I have nothing left to preach about." And the mentor replies, "Then make a pastoral call." And third, reverence for the fire. When Emerson referred to life passed through the fire of thought, he meant the kind of fire that a craftsperson uses to temper the raw pottery, to make the works whole and durable. Life is the fire that tempers us and can make us strong if we don't crumble in the process. Life is a kind of refining fire that drives off impurities in our clay. By a quirk of fate, the day I was ordained, and that was 27 years ago in May 22nd, that happened to be Pentecost Sunday. Well, I reflected a great deal about the story of Pentecost in the Christian scriptures. You might remember the story in the Bible about the time after Jesus' death, when his followers were gathered to remember him and plan how they would live their lives without him. As the legend has it, they were filled with such fervor and such passion that flames appeared over their heads. Now, I was reasonably certain that no fires would break out over the heads of the congregation in my home church during my ordination, but the metaphor of fire was and is powerful. It occurs to me that all ministers must be filled with the fire of conviction. It is conviction that impels us clergy to become visible to others, visible through our support of causes and ideals that make for larger thought and fuller life. Conviction and courage are fired and fueled by reverence for thought and life, by an unending desire to preserve and enlarge them. When the time comes, perhaps a year from now, when you meet your candidate for the called ministry here, you will want to find out what convictions give him or her courage. I can only speak for myself. For me, what gave me courage was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He first introduced me, through his words and deeds, to the concept of nonviolence in the realm of political action. I had seen people on the news and in the papers exercising nonviolent resistance, but I did not have the language for it until I read and listened to Dr. King. And his conviction inspired in me an answering commitment, one that remains with me throughout my life, which I would call a fire for nonviolent political action. I revere the fire for justice in so many persons with whom I have worked on anti-racism and anti-war efforts. It is a fire that fuels my conviction and inspires my courage. Your months of transition as a congregation are continuing, but our work together is not over. During this time of transition and change, you are experiencing great opportunities for ministering to one another and for being ministered to. You may not all wish to be reverends, but surely you are engaging in reverence for thought, for life, and for the fire. So here we are in this month of March with its daily miracles, stirring dull roots with spring rain and perhaps breeding lilacs out of the dead land. Annie Dillard reminds us that no matter how dull the roots may seem and how dead the land may seem, the pennies and free gifts of existence are generously strewn in our path. Surprise ahead, money this way. In reverence, with a capacity for awe that brings with it the capacity for respecting fellow human beings, flaws and all, may we minister fully and freely to one another. So may it be.
Our parting words are from Laura Lynn Bellamy. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace.